Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll while away a sultry afternoon in a Brazilian cafe as the warm sounds of acoustic bossa nova and samba float through the air.
O vento faz rendezvous no seu cabelo alinhado, acostumado com meu embolado.
I'm Rosalie Howard. Join us for Brazilian Cafe, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Friday night at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Support for Utah Public Radio is brought to you by USU's Anthropology Museum in Old Main. It's free Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, Saturdays 10 to 4. This Saturday explores zombies in a cross-cultural fashion, including games and a zombie survival kit.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. Teresa Small, author of the book, How to Love an Addict, joins me on the phone to talk about her book and journey with a meth-addicted son. She lives next door in Idaho, where she writes and works as chief financial officer for an agricultural company.
I'm a tribal member with the Shoshone Bannock Tribes in Fort Hall, Idaho. I grew up, never really have moved out of southeastern Idaho, and lived here all my life. Have two sons, 27 and 25. And I have two stepdaughters who are also 27 and 25. And we have three grandchildren, actually four, as of December 31st. I have written as long as I can remember. I have a pretty large portfolio of poetry, articles, essays, some short stories, some of which are copyrighted and published on the Internet, Totem Tales, which is a kind of lengthy child's book. And it's kind of related to environmental health for the earth. This particular book was inspired by pain, I think. My youngest son got involved with drugs right around the age of 13. He's 25 years old now. And we went through quite a lot of trauma as he went through his teen years and his early 20s. And the things that I learned about addiction and learned about myself and learned about the effects of addiction on the family, I just felt like they needed to be shared because I knew there was a lot of help, there was a lot of written material, a lot of things out there for addicts and their recovery, but there's not that much support out there for the family of addicts and the people who relate to and love the addict themselves. Because truly, they suffer right along with the addiction. And rather than writing another tragic story about my son and the pain that I experienced and the actual events that, you know, led up to today, I wanted to write a book that was more of a how-to manual that people could reference and say, well, this is how I feel. What do I do about it? Or this is the situation that we're in, the relationship that we have, how do I change it? And so the book was actually quite a bit lengthier in the beginning, and I cut back to a smaller version that was a more condensed handy manual, I guess.
Yeah, and your title is really, it really struck me and as interesting because it's called How to Love an Addict, which is normally what you don't hear in the mainstream media or in the media at all about addiction. It's usually the reverse. It's tough love, right?
Yeah, and there's a little of that necessary.
Can you talk about the reaction to the book within your community and family and readers?
I've had so much support from friends and family and the community in general. I'm also a volunteer leader in this area for the Idaho Meth Project, and they've been very supportive as well. And it's been received, interestingly, because I've actually had people that I don't know very well come to me and share some of their personal stories and some of the pain in their life that they just didn't really want to be honest about. So it's interesting how it opens people up.
because you just really can't begin the healing process or make a change in the relationship until you tell the truth. And I try and really expand on that point in the book.
And how did you first discover or learn that your son was using meth?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I was in denial for a very long time about the meth. I knew there were things like marijuana and, you know, all the other drugs involved. But it took me, I wish I could remember the actual pinnacle point. We did take him to the emergency room at one point, and there was a toxicology test involved. He did test positive for methamphetamine. And at one point, he just plainly admitted to me that he was using meth. A lot of the symptoms of, I'm not sure how I want to put this, their personality changes so drastically that you don't recognize the person physically, mentally, emotionally. And I'm his mother, so I've raised this child, you know, from birth. I know him, and he became a person that I did not recognize in any manner. And when I began to question him, he was fairly honest about it, and I don't mean to make light of it like it was a discussion, because it didn't take place like that. There were medical issues involved, and I do point out in the book that at one point he ended up in the psych ward at our local hospital for about a week with schizophrenia, drug-induced schizophrenia, which is fairly common with meth. And a lot of his past history and his the depth of his use at that time came from that visit. We learned a lot about him at that time. The time he ended up in the hospital, he was probably right around 20 years of age. He did manage to get his GED, go through the Job Corps program, and get a vocational certificate in carpentry in the midst of his drug use, which I had to be proud of him for, ironically, because he had dropped out of high school in the 10th grade. And he was the third child of the four. They were raised together. And the other three children were, you know, seemingly normal. They got good grades. They were socially active. You know, we had the regular struggles of childhood, but nothing that even set the stage for this kind of an addiction and problems that come with it. So it was new to us. It was tragic to think that I had a high school dropout, and we just took it from there and rode the ride. It was a wild ride.
And what were some of the signs and symptoms of it that you, you yourself experienced and your family, your other children?
There's a lot of contention with methamphetamine use, personality change, and anger. Anger over little things, specifically punching holes in the walls, just a lack of interest in anything, very odd hours, unusual behavior like clenching of teeth or snapping fingers, picking at their hair, picking at their skin. Meth tends to make people sweat profusely. There are a lot of physical symptoms that you can watch for. My son in particular didn't suffer the meth mouth that can be sometimes common with meth addicts. He does have some cracked teeth and dental work now, but he didn't actually have the gum disease and, you know, that type of physical symptom. But you can tell when someone's that angry, and the windows are the eyes to the soul. There ceases to be anything in there. There's no depth. They're dark. They're dilated. And there just is no emotion. They're void. They're void of emotion. And understand, currently, my son's 25 years old. So this was a 12-year process for us. And I would like to say right up front, he is doing really well now. He has almost 2 years in January, clean and sober. Some of it not by choice, because he was subject to prison time at the end of his run. And so a lengthy treatment program, and
just a lot of resources from the state. Medical professionals have helped him get to where he is. And that's not that common with meth addicts, so I feel blessed for that. One particular circumstance that kind of shows the extremity of the situation. My son had come home one afternoon, and we live in a rural area with a small acreage, and he just immediately pulled his car behind our shop and parked in the back. He and a friend came into the house as though nothing was going on and asked if I could give them a ride to this friend's home. So I said, sure, you know, let me finish what I'm doing here in the kitchen and I'll give you a ride. So we jumped in my car and backed out of the driveway, and no sooner did I get out of my driveway, I was immediately surrounded by about 8 vehicles. There were local city police, county sheriff, and U.S. Marshals in unmarked vehicles. They came up to me with loaded guns, asked me to exit the car. Two of them took me by either arm, and they took the boys out of the car. I shouldn't say boys, they're young men. Put them in the prone position in the street right in front of our home. There was no warrant for my son at the time, but his friend had a felony warrant, and they took both of the boys in and escorted me back to my front porch where my husband was waiting. And I don't know if you've ever had a loaded gun pointed at you, but I have grown up in what seems to be a typical American suburbia childhood situation. That type of thing is what I see on TV. It's not the reality of my life. And that day, because of my son's addiction, it became the reality of my life. I had no idea what these people were doing. I had no idea why they were there. It was terrifying. And that was the day, the point and the time, that I knew that I had to change the relationship that I had with my son. In order to keep myself safe, and, you know, the other members of my family that frequent my home.
What were some of the changes that you made in your relationship with your son at that point?
One of the primary changes that I made was to change the way that I communicated with him. I had, to that point, tried to convince him, tried to talk to him as a mother would to a son, you know, about the right and wrong and these kinds of normal type issues. And it was then that I began to realize that addicts, they process and they live in two states of mind. One of them is under the influence, and one of them is seeking the influence. So they're either using or they're obsessing. And when a person's not in their right mind, it's really difficult to try and convince them that they need to be well or try and convince them that they're ruining your life and theirs. And I realized that was so simple and yet so deep because I was literally trying to speak to someone and deal with someone who was not in their right mind. This person had changed into someone that I did not know. Criminal behavior, physical and emotional, you know, symptoms just oozing out of him at every point. And I knew that that just had to become someone that I would treat without the emotional contact of a mother and a son. I had to put my toe line in the sand.
And so at that point, did you start to treat it like a disease? And
I absolutely started to treat it like a disease for him and for myself because I started at that point to see the enablement that I had provided to him. I had provided him a home and a safe place and, you know, all of the comforts of home. And I knew at that point that he was using that as an umbrella.
Right. And so then there was some tough love that you had.
Absolutely.
What did you kick him out at that?
There was really no kicking out at that point because he would live with friends, go from friends to friends. And he would just come in at odd hours, you know, in and out. We did take the key away from him, explain to him that this was my life. I chose not to live my life as a criminal. I chose not to put my life in danger. And that he was not to bring anyone to my house and not to come to my house unless he was clean and sober. And after that period of time, I did not see him for quite a long time. There was a, that year, I believe, at Christmas, on Christmas Day, he called, did tell me Merry Christmas, but that he couldn't come home. He didn't have any clean clothes, and he was embarrassed. And I think that may have been one of his low points. Meth addicts tend to crash when they haven't used for a couple of days. They have peaks and valleys. That was definitely one of his valleys. But there was no more money. There was no more invitation as our home being open to him under those conditions. A variety of things like that, that you just, you know, put yourself in a safe place.
How has your son received the book?
He was very excited about it as I was writing it. When I finished it, he was incarcerated, and I mailed him a copy, and I got a letter back from him that was supportive, but a bit melancholy. He had been working on his recovery and dealing with some issues, you know, through that period of time, and I'm not sure he understood the depth of the pain that it had caused me and our family, because they don't consider you when they're full-blown addiction. It's not about you. And after about 3 or 4 months, he had actually written me another letter and told me that he had passed the book on to some of his counselors, and that his counselors had read it and were applying, you know, some of the things, talking back to him, having them speaking back to them, kind of using it, you know, in a ping-pong game there, as part of his recovery. And that made me very happy. And now he is just very supportive, but he's healthy. When he was arrested, I believe it was in December or January 2009, right around there, he weighed 120 pounds, and he's 6'4", wow. And he now weighs 185 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah.
The cover of your book is quite beautiful. Can you talk about the cover, who did the cover, and what it means?
This cover was drawn by a woman who was under the influence of meth. She spent several hours with ink, you know, making each individual little dot and drawing this picture that's apparently a monster in her mind. And as soon as she was done drawing, she grabbed a lighter, grabbed the picture, and torched it. And her intention was just to burn it after she had spent hours in this concentrated state. The person that was with her grabbed the picture out of her hand, put the fire out, and my son ended up with it and brought it home. And I just thought that the detail and the eccentricity that came with it was just incredible. And I kept it for a very long time before I was even done with the book, and I just felt compelled to use it for the cover because it shows the insanity that can come with not just meth addiction, with every addiction. Meth is just such an extremely addictive substance, and the chemical properties of it just make it horrendous. But all addiction creates that insanity in perfectly normal people.
Did you ever think or expect that you would become such an expert on addiction?
No. And I thank God every day that writing was my hobby, because that's how I deal with things. And those who are writers understand that. Even people who don't care to write, you know, as a hobby or as a profession, keeping a journal can be healthy. And when you have that that vision to look at, to go back and get some historical data, and to maybe replay your emotions as they were in that moment, it really does cause personal growth. And it can really show you the difference between then and now, and how you were able to cope with it then versus how you cope with it now. So for me, writing about it wasn't an option. But because of the subject matter, I felt like it needed to be shared.
And you talked about how it weaves its way into all of our communities. And
yeah, absolutely. Being a volunteer leader for the Idaho Meth Project, I went above and beyond my learning just with my son by volunteering for them. I've learned that meth used to be referred to as hillbilly heroin, and primarily was manufactured in
trailer parks in rural communities, that type of thing, storage sheds. A lot of those mini labs have just been abolished, and we now have what they call super labs in Mexico. And this product is transported across the border into the United States in mass quantities. Meth is also easily made now in plastic, like 1 liter 7-Up soda pop bottles. And I don't know how you make it, but the chemicals that go into it, they put in the bottle, they shake it, and it makes meth. So that's a problem with truck drivers and mobile-type inner-city labs. Very easy to make, very affordable, and very accessible.
That was Teresa Small. For more information about the book, go online at howtoloveanaddict.com. Sherry Quinn for Access Utah.
And if there's one message that anyone gets out of this book, it is that in order to love an addict, you must love yourself first. And you need to apply the steps, put the principles into action, and put yourself first in that situation, and then change the type of relationship that you have with the addict. That's the quickest way to get them to correct their addiction and want to help themselves. The best way to make a change in the world is to make a change in yourself.
Thank you for joining us on Access Utah. I'm Carrie Bringhurst. 2012, celebrating diversity in the West, is the focus of administrative leaders in Western land-grant institutions, including Utah State University. Chuck Gay is Associate Vice President for Extension at USU and is among those meeting this week in Park City for the Western Region Joint Summer Meetings.
Every land-grant university in the Western states, from Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, Montana, west, actually to Guam, all the way on the other side of the international dateline. So it's every state, including Hawaii, a western state, and then every trust territory in the Pacific are part of the western region. We come together every year, a different university hosts. This is our turn. Directors of the agricultural experiment stations, which are located at each of these land-grant universities, and the directors of extension, the deans of agriculture, and usually associate deans for academic programs associated with agricultural sciences and education.
And it just so happens that they're coming to Utah at a time when there's a celebration of land-grant institutions. We're marking an anniversary this year.
That's correct. It's really interesting. In 1862, a number of things all came together at once. Started off May 15th with the creation of what is now the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
One of the largest federal agencies now in the United States.
Yeah. President Lincoln and his cabinet put this concept together because, of course, in 1862, a little over 80% of the entire population of the country was engaged in some form of agriculture. And we were also in the westward expansion. So two other really important things came together, and that was the Homestead Act. Almost all of our private land in Utah was proved up under the Homestead Act. And then the Railroad Act, which was instrumental in bringing the Transcontinental Railroad together, which, of course, came together at Promontory. But the really interesting part of all of that, including the creation of the land-grant universities July 2nd of 1862, was that the country was broke, had a huge debt because we were engaged in the Civil War, but had lots of land. And so in almost all of these cases, the federal government provided land to in lieu of either the work that was being done, like the creation of the railroads, land for homesteading, and land to support the land-grant universities, that the way it gets its name. We still have those lands in Utah that provide support.
So when you gather during this event in Park City and talking about diversity in the West, I guess this might be a good time to reflect on how things have maybe changed over the years when this was first started.
Well, it's true. And one of the really changes in diversity is not just ethnic diversity. Of course, we've had those changes as well. But is demographic diversity. According to this past census, Utah now is 90% urban, which means we have this huge state with a lot of open land and not very many people because, of course, we're all clustered along the Wasatch Front. Some of the other states that we tend to think as these big open western states like Nevada, incredibly urbanized, with almost all of the population in Las Vegas and Reno, or maybe even next door in Carson City. And you look across the western states, so we have these clusters of the sort of the megapolis, if you will, where most of the people reside, and then lots of open land. And of course, this is fostered somewhat because we're public land states. And so we don't have people residing on public lands.
Why was the theme diversity chosen?
Well, we're dealing with a number of things. One is that we're trying to build diversity, ethnic diversity and gender diversity among our student base. And so that's one of the themes that we're going to look at. And we're bringing in Dr. Romero from Texas A&M University, who's going to be helping develop that theme with our own Dr. Morales from Student Services. In addition to that, we're bringing Dr. Robert Lang from the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, who is the director of the Western version of the Brookings Institute, who is a demographer, a very well-known demographer, who's going to talk to us about the demographic changes that have occurred in the West and the impact that that's having on the economy, our programs, our ability to serve the public, all of those sorts of things.
Do you feel there is as much interest in land-grant institutions today as there was when President Lincoln first initiated the program?
Well, yes. And if you couple that with the public universities that followed, almost except for Brigham Young, all of our institutions of higher education are either public or the land-grant university. And it's what has vaulted sort of the common man forward, because our ability to attain higher education, because in 1862, there were only private schools, and only the wealthy and the well-to-do families were able to support those schools. So it had a huge impact. One of the interesting sidelights is that Justin Morrill, the senator in the U.S. Congress that wrote the Morrill Act, and incidentally, can you imagine today how many volumes of paper it would take to do a Morrill Act to create a land-grant university? It was just two handwritten pages.
And it's carried through all of these years.
It's carried all that for 150 years, and now has created this great machine that creates the research that feeds the world. He was just a very good man who had risen to a position of prominence in Vermont.
So someone to celebrate.
It, absolutely, yeah.
Will you do anything special during this event to maybe recognize him or the work that was done 150 years ago?
No. Each of the schools has had their own celebration. And on July 2nd, many of the land-grant universities came together in Washington, D.C. To celebrate the date and the Morrill Act.
But this event will be specifically for the Western
Just
states.
For the Western states. That's correct.
You can hear the complete interview and learn more about the Western Region Joint Summer Meeting online at upr.org. We've been speaking with Chuck Gay, Associate Vice President for Extension at Utah State University, among those meeting this week in Park City for the Western Region Joint Summer Meetings. If you would like to learn more about the summer meetings or Utah State University's Cooperative Extension Program, go to extension.usu.edu. I'm Carrie Bringhurst. Thanks for joining us today on Access Utah.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
This is folk singer Michael Jonathan. We're celebrating the blues with two great blues masters, Lurie Bell and Lisa Bialas. It's music and conversation on the next broadcast of the Wood Sounds, Old Time Radio.
Friday night at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
From Public Radio Internet.